Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners, and thank you for listening. Without you, we are nothing.
We are nothing. David Swenson, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we're in studio this week.
Boy,
because
it was
we had a special conversation.
God, it was a fun show. I really enjoyed myself this week.
Our old friend Joe Ellis, Dr. Joseph Ellis of Mount Holyoke, called us from Vermont, called you, and said he's got a new book coming, and would we like to talk a little bit about it?
And I said, yeah, of course, but why don't you come on early before the book's out, and we can just kind of talk about what's coming? And he said, really, do you think anybody would be interested? I said, yes.
You know, I expected this to be kind of friendly pro forma, and then we got into this conversation, and it got deep fast.
Yeah,
I was surprised at a couple of things. First of all, he's using his lifelong study of the founding fathers in American history to talk about the current troubled situation and not just about the presidency.
He was troubled too. He is troubled. And listening to the two of you, I kind of wanted to jump in and say, now, wait a minute, guys, you know, this is just one little piece of history in a long period of our nation. You know, it's going to come and go.
That's
as alarming as it is.
His view is two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of his liberal friends think two steps forward, seven steps back. Some people think we're heading towards the dark ages here. He's a relative optimist, but he is concerned, and he wanted to see what you always do. So when I get worked up on this show, as I do sometimes, you say, wait a minute, this is not the first time we've had this. We've done this before.
Excuse me, but you know who taught me that.
I know, but the point is we do that for each
Jefferson.
Other.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wanted to hear him say, what in our history is parallel or analogous or helps us think about this in context? And he does. He's great about this. He says, look, this is not our first rodeo. You know, we've been here before. But he did say that the lack of civility and deportment and respect for our basic norms by the current president is unprecedented. He said there have been other populist, even demagogic presidents, but this is the first one that's made a kind of a hobby out of just nihilistically shattering all the norms. And so I think that's why he's alarmed.
Well, you know, I think people on both sides of the arguments are alarmed. And before we get away from it again, the name of his book, and it's coming out in October.
October Knopf. American Dialogue, The Founders and Us.
And rumor has it this may become a Jefferson Hour book club entry.
It is going to be. He's agreed to come on. He's sending us the proofs. We have to read the book in advance.
Terrific.
I'm very excited about it. He said, interestingly, to me, Clay, you and I are not going to agree on my treatment of Jefferson, but I'm very eager to have the conversation about it. And I thought,
I'm intrigued. So we do talk about the five features of better arguments in the show and a couple other things, but mostly we talk to Professor Ellis in the second segment. So hope you enjoy that.
So I'm going to ask our listeners, our podcast listeners, to write to us. Here's what I want them to say. There are people who think that we are on the edge of madness, darkness, and national collapse.
Right.
And there are people who think, thank God Almighty, we're going to be saved because of Donald Trump.
Yep.
Finally, someone's standing up to the establishment. On a scale of 1 to 10, I want to ask our listeners, how concerned are you? If 10 means the house is on fire and we may not survive this, and 1 is, no, this is good even. This is good, healthy shaking up of our system. Where are you? I'd like to have people say, from their own point of view, not trying to please anybody, but just speak the truth. Where you are on the concern scale, are you jubilant that Donald Trump is shaking the world, or are you as alarmed as it's possible to be, or somewhere in the middle? And people write to us, and they can put in little sentences, and we'll quote some of that.
We could do a whole show on that.
I'd like to hear what people have to say, because I'll tell you what, I meet people every day who say, this is the end of civilization as we know it. But I also meet people every day who say, this
Boy,
is fantastic.
Great. Somebody's finally, yeah. Right,
you know,
yeah.
We needed this. The system was broken. We need to shake it up. We need to
I just like
drain
to think
the swamp.
I like to think the system was written for times like this in order to change, correct, listen. You know, it's who's paying attention and who's making the squeaky wheel.
Well, we'll see. But I would very much be interested in getting a kind of a barometric reading of our listenership about where you think this is and how alarmed you are, if you are alarmed, or how jubilant you are, if that's your response. And so the more people that we get to respond to this, the more of a real survey we'll have. I don't presume anything. I think Jefferson is a crossover figure. I was thinking about him today, David. You know, he's really a radical libertarian. And so he's a Tea Party guy. He's a Pat Buchanan guy in certain moods. But he also is a progressive. He's a man of the Enlightenment. It would be almost impossible to say what Jefferson would actually think if he popped into the world in 2018. I think that it's a mistake to presume that we know what he would be by now, since, of course, he died on July 4th, 1826, on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the writing of the Declaration of Independence.
So let's go to the show. And I didn't really credit this fellow as much as maybe I should have during it. But the beginning of our first segment of the show is about the five features of better arguments. I have to credit Eric Liu, a former speechwriter and policy advisor in the Clinton administration. And this comes from a presentation he did at the Aspen Ideas Festival, co-hosted by the Atlantic Magazine and the Aspen Institute.
I want to go to that festival. And I also want to say to people, I just came off my 17th trip up the Wendover Death March on the Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour. I was not drowned. I did not have a heart attack. I did cough up a lung a couple of times. But I want to invite people.
What a wonderful image.
I want to invite people to come to the Humanities Retreats this winter. January 13th through 18th, Water in the West. It's the book club you always wanted. January 19th through 24th, Shakespeare Without Tears. And then our cultural tour in March, March 2nd through 8th, John Steinbeck's California. So go to jeffersonhour.com to get details on these. These are filling up fast. I want people to just come and have the book discussions they have always dreamed of having in a beautiful, serene, retro kind of resort just west of Missoula. So look for all of that. Steinbeck's California, Shakespeare Without Tears, and Water and the West. Let's listen now to this out-of-character edition with the great Dr. Joseph Ellis of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Seated across from me this week is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and it's good to see you, Clay.
Back from the annual Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour in Montana, and I don't not drowned. I didn't die on the Wendover Death March, and I just want to say before we go on, these trips, these cultural tours are so much fun. The next two are winter retreats at Locksaw Lodge, west of Missoula, one on Water in the West, and one on Shakespeare Without Tears. And then there's the John Steinbeck tour of Monterey and the Central Valley of California. I just love these tours, David, and people can find out more about them at jeffersonhour.com.
And I'm glad to see you back, safe and sound.
Tan,
in
rested.
In one piece.
Yes.
Not drowned.
Not drowned.
And peace with Becky. She didn't get after you this time. And
the thing is she canoed with her daughter, Jessie.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know if Jesse's even alive, but I know that I was in a kayak and I'm very much
well,
okay.
Well, I hope she heard that almost love letter that you read to her.
I read the letter aloud at Locksaw Lodge on the final night.
And
I was crying because I love Becky. And the people realized that this is we've had, 20 years of working together. We're kind of moving in slightly different directions now, but they saw we're brother-sister love.
She was able to take your abuse for 20 years, and you were able to take hers.
And ditto, honey.
No, there's a time. We live in some pretty, what's the correct word?
Times. Volatile. Let's call it volatile.
And a couple of things I've run into that I wanted to talk to you about. One, I can't credit, because I can't remember, but it was how to better argue points with different political thoughts. And the statement of the article was, it's not a good place to start a political conversation with who did you vote for. It's much better to start from a point of what do you believe in? What do you stand for? I thought that was good advice. I mean, pretty simplistic, but good advice.
Very Jeffersonian, too. Look for the common ground. So when he would write a letter to somebody that he was at odds with, he was a master at this, and he would do everything in his power on the first page to show common ground. They understood each other's children, or they had gardens.
Artificial good humor, right?
And he would, so then there would be an establishment of harmony, and a common understanding of what it is to be an American and a common goal. We all want peace, or we all want a balanced budget, or we all want a mix between states' rights and federal authority. And once he had done everything in his power to find as much common ground as possible, then he would say, "Now, my friend, we may disagree, but if we do, we disagree as rational friends. I have a different view of the alien and sedition laws than you do, and I'm going to play it out. I might be wrong. I probably am wrong, but these are my own convictions. They're honest convictions. There's no posturing in them." So you see what Jefferson was doing. He was constantly putting in disclaimers. He was saying that he might not be righteous. He might not know everything. He might need to be better informed. And he also wanted to make sure that he didn't break with people he cared about just because they had serious, sometimes really serious, policy disagreements.
Well, I know it's really difficult sometimes in using your word, the volatile times that we live in, to understand those who you disagree with. And disagreements are pretty severe. I mean, they're turning into violence. So, you know, as I say, the Jefferson Hour, I'm very proud when people say, "Well, what's the show about?" And it's about civil discourse. We can disagree without flying into some rage or passion. So I thought, okay, well, what can we do to help people with that?
You know, I've been trying to self-restrain myself, David, because we do live in a very interesting moment here, and we're all stirred up. I think there's a national chaotic energy that's floating around. Everyone's worried, everyone's angry, everyone's upset, frustrated, suspicious. There's a whole anxiety that's really deeply woven into everything now that happens. And I think it's having a really erosive effect on our national fabric. And so I feel like it's my duty, to the extent that I can, as a humanities scholar who's spent a lot of time studying the past, to try to ratchet things down, to place them in a historical context, to make sure I check my own politics and my own opinions as much as possible, to be aware that, I mean, I think the key Jeffersonian insight is that the other guy has a point. Boy, that's hard to remember. So if you take someone like Michael Savage or Sean Hannity and you're watching, I mean this to be centrist, whoever it is that you're watching or listening to, you need to think, that person has a point. I may disagree. There may even be some serious disputes about facts on the ground, but that person has a legitimate point of view. And why do I think that my point of view is so much more legitimate than hers? That way madness lies. And so legitimizing with respect, with real respect, points of view that are not your own is almost the key to being a mature human being. And all of us fail. I know I do. This just happens, but we have to check it. We have to, at no point in my lifetime has it been more necessary, I think, to self-restrain when you think you're right.
Agreed.
Well, it's hard, though.
It's really hard.
Really, really hard.
In that spirit, I came across an article that was published in The Atlantic by Connor Friedersdorf. He was at an Aspen Institute, and a gentleman by the name of Eric Liu, who used to be part of the Clinton administration, presented 5 features of better arguments.
So there are 5 things we can do to make our arguments, in the sense of shouting at each other, but our disputes, our conversations more civil.
And it's a little simplistic, but I thought I would go through it and maybe have you comment and see what you think, or give Jefferson's
perspective. I'll provide a Jeffersonian comment.
Okay. So number one, take winning off the table. Rather than seeking victory, the goal should be truth-seeking, with a reinstitution of civility in service of achieving it. Participants are charged with arguing in order to better understand.
That's 100% Jeffersonian. Is try to find in the other point of view that which you think is legitimate. Bend over backwards to try to see what doesn't really ring true to you. But above all, to say, we're friends here. We're both Americans here. We need to get through this together.
Funny you should say we're both Americans here, because I think that's sort of in our nature as Americans, as we go into, we are right. We're going to convince the other guy you are wrong. I mean, it takes a certain vulnerability to go in and say, well, maybe I am wrong. Maybe the point of this is not to win, but that single approach alone, I think, would really further things. It's difficult to do, though.
So Franklin said, and Jefferson quoted him in his letter to his grandson in 1880, Franklin would say, instead of arguing, ask follow-up questions. Tease out that person's thought. Why do you feel that immigration is destroying America? Why do you feel that the trillion-dollar deficit is going to lead to the death of American civilization? Why do you believe that Obamacare is the worst thing that was ever passed by the Congress of the United States? Ask follow-up questions and ask them with respect. You're not trying to trap somebody in some sort of a Socratic way. You're saying, what's the basis of your view of that? And that will then maybe lead to some sort of a common ground.
I think that's the trick is finding a common ground to start from. Take winning off the table.
Take winning off the table, even right. though we all want to win.
Yep. Number two, prioritize relationships and listen passionately. As one audience member put it, the most constructive and rewarding arguments they've ever had have involved people with whom maintaining a good relationship afterward was a high priority. And impetuous for speaking and listening carefully. Prioritize relationships and listen passionately.
I agree 100%. That's very Jeffersonian also. I mean, all these 5 points are straight out of the Jefferson playbook. You know, the usual example of this that we always hear is that Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy would argue in the Senate, and then they'd go out for a beer afterwards, or that people can really be friends mm-hmm. and say, look, when I get in the Senate, I'm going to really go after you, and I'm going to say that you're dangerous, but afterwards, you get it. We can go out for dinner, and we care about each other, and I understand that this is not personal. And Jefferson's always saying this. He's always saying the friendship is more important than the dispute. Can we maintain the friendship? Because the friendship is about a whole range of things, and the dispute is about tariffs or taxation or about policy vis-a-vis France or Great Britain. And so Jefferson practiced this. Now, I have to say, some of his enemies thought that Jefferson was duplicitous, that he was very harmonious at a dinner party or in a conversation or over a glass of Bordeaux, and then he would go away, and he and Madison would write vicious things later, and so that they didn't see a one-to-one relationship between Jefferson's civility and then whatever he was doing behind the scenes. I think that's a fair criticism of a few moments in Jefferson's life. But his general attitude was friendship is more important than politics.
I'll give you the third and fourth points together. 3, pay attention to context. And 4, embrace vulnerability. He says that most of these arguments are ageless American arguments, things we've been talking about forever.
The whole basis of the Jefferson Hour is the agelessness of our national discourse.
Mm-hmm.
These questions have been racking American life from the time of Jefferson and Hamilton, from the time of Abraham Lincoln, from the time of Andrew Jackson, from the time of Theodore Roosevelt. This is the nature of it.
And embrace vulnerability, extend the olive branch. Hard to do. And then finally, the fifth point was be open. You cannot possibly change another person's mind if you're not willing to have your own mind changed.
We read that again. That's so important.
You cannot possibly change another person's mind if you're not willing to have your own mind changed.
So I want to ask everyone who's listening, David, when is the last time that your opinion, your mind on an important subject was changed by a conversation? Because that's essential, is that we each, put it in more simplistic terms, we each have to give a little. Everyone has to compromise a little in order to make this work. But I'd like to be convinced of something that I think is wrong. I'm always eager for an argument that will enlighten me or remind me of something I didn't think of or show me that my thinking was simplistic or shallow. That's what I look for in friendship and in argument.
A good place to end. Right now, we need to take a short break, Clay. But in our next segment, we're going to be joined in conversation by Professor Joseph Ellis. And here's how Mr. Ellis feels about America today.
We're facing conditions and circumstances which in some ways are unprecedented. And how we handle this is to be determined. But the end of Tocqueville's Democracy in America has a line that I like. When he looked at America in the 1830s, he said, "I am full of apprehension and hope." And that pretty well describes me.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Seated across from me is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson, and we are so pleased this week to be joined in conversation by one of the good friends of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the author, Mr. Joseph Ellis. But he says, call me Joe.
Is an amazing man. And to my mind, he's the best scholar of the early national period that we have. His insights have had an enormous influence on American culture, just profound influence on my own thinking. Two books that I just adore, American Sphinx, the character of Thomas Jefferson, and Passionate Sage about John Adams. But his newest book, which will be out in October, is called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. And he's going to come on for a full hour, but in the short term, we asked him if he would agree to come on and at least tease out a few of the thoughts that will be in the larger book. What surprised me, because he's a historian, in other words, looking back at the past, is he kind of wanted to talk about the current moment.
He did.
I was a little, surprised, weren't you?
Well, yes and no, because I think the book is how did he put it?
How does the past inform this situation,
right,
or this set of situations?
And how he spent his life in the past, writing about the past.
David, I'm so interested in our listeners hearing Joe Ellis's insights. Let's go to that. Let's pick up the conversation in midstream here.
Good. I'm coming to you from the far reaches of the Green Mountains in Vermont on a hot August day, but I'm pleased to be with you.
How close are you to being done with this book? And it out the door.
Oh, it's done. It's done. It's been done for months. But you know how it takes a lot while, Clay, to process a book. It's due to come out officially in October.
And the title is, sir?
The title is American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. And as some of you know, I tend to write about the founders in the 18th century. And I'm doing this here, but in a different way. I'm trying to establish notion that there's an ongoing dialogue between us and them. Now, I'm the first person to tell you that the founders are busy being dead. They cannot come back. And we can't just ask Jefferson what he really thinks of Donald Trump or what George Washington thinks of our war in Afghanistan. What we can do, and of course I've done, is go back and read their papers and in this particular instance, the book was originally conceived and the research and writing began prior to the election of Donald Trump. So it's not a book about the Trump presidency. It is, however, in some sense, a book about the conditions and the political movements that have made Trump possible, and about the fact that we're in a backlash moment in American history. People are dazed and confused and for good reason. And there tend to be people tend to occupy very isolated political camps or apps or whatever. And so the title of the book, American Dialogue, is to some extent, you remember the old Joan Rivers line, can we talk?
Yes.
Can we talk? Can we try to argue about where we are and where we're going and use the founders as a source of wisdom that might allow us to have a safe place to meet and to talk about this with civility, but with fervor?
I think that's for me, Joe, that's the very definition of the humanities, to be able to talk about us through the lens of the past in a disciplined and rigorous and historically grounded way, taking what insights we can from the past, but freely acknowledging things that we can't turn to the past for clarification on whatsoever. Let me ask you this question. Of all the founding fathers, and I'll take you all the way up to, say, James Polk, who's the most Trump-like character that we see there?
Probably Andrew Jackson. Though Jackson did have political experience and certainly military experience, he did serve one term in Congress, and he was, most famous as a military man. But I think he was a populist who won election with an electorate that was like Trump's, upset with the direction of the country under the Federalists and under John Quincy Adams. And instead of the wall Jackson had the bank.
The Bank of the United States.
As the he wanted to do away with the bank, the National Bank, and that became his major thing. When he eventually killed the bank, it destroyed the economy and went into deep recession. But again, much like Trump, he wasn't really blamed for it. So I don't think there's anybody that's quite identical in anything like to Trump, because Trump's sui generis and distinctive and unprecedented. But if you're looking for someone back there who resembles him in any way, it's Jackson. And I think that they used to have a picture of Jackson in the back of the Oval Office. I mean, they brought one in when he was elected. And I'm not sure it's still there, but they seem themselves to see him as a president.
The subtitle of your book is The Founders and Us. It's always easier for historians to write about them than it is about us. Let's go to Jefferson for a minute.
All right, let's just say the historians are really, really good at predicting the past. In fact, they are omniscient about that. But they're no better than anybody else at predicting the future. In fact, they know from history that most prophets are wrong. So I realize that my then and now thing is, I'm a historian. I know about the then, or I think I know about the then. Making the connection to the now, I'm a citizen who's historically informed, but I don't claim to be a prophet.
Of course. And here's my question, Joe. If part of the backlash is about race, civil rights, equality, but race, Jefferson would appear to me to be right at the historical center of this national dialogue / agony.
I think you're right. And that's the reason he's the first chapter in the book, which is race. It's Jefferson, a long essay on Jefferson, and then there's a somewhat shorter essay called Abiding Backlash. And I think that what I'm trying to suggest here is that if once you understand what Jefferson really believed and thought, then you would realize that it was very naive to presume that the election of Barack Obama was going to be the opening of post-racial America. Instead, it was going to be exactly the opposite. It was going to create a backlash of people who really have never fully believed in the civil rights movement and the belief in racial equality or biracial society. And those people and those values are deeply embedded in American history, and that Jefferson is simultaneously the spokesman for the values that led to the civil rights movement and a very articulate spokesman for the belief that blacks and whites can never live together in harmony.
Now, that's the question I have. So trying to read Jefferson without all of the racist baggage, I want to look at him as a prophet. He said several times in the course of his life that it was not clear to him that we could be a biracial republic.
Right. Well, the main reason that Jefferson could never end up arguing how to end slavery, even though he recognized and said very clearly that slavery was incompatible with the values of the Revolution as he knew them, that the only way in which slavery could end is for emancipation to be followed immediately by expatriation, by which he meant sending all the freed slaves somewhere else. The somewhere else could have been Africa, could have been the West Indies. Initially, he thought it might be the West. That was early in his thinking, but that didn't work out. And in the end, when he had a chance to do that in the Louisiana Purchase, he said, no, that's not possible. Because he believed that any kind of multiracial society would eventually become a society that corrupted the purity of the Anglo-Saxon race. And he believed that. And a lot of people who were abolitionists, you know, like, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, at the end of Uncle Tom's Cabin, has a appendix saying, and now after we free them, here's where they should all go, to Liberia. So that Jefferson is not atypical in believing that slaves once freed need to be sent somewhere else.
Even Lincoln flirted with some of these ideas.
Even Lincoln thought that. And during the war in 1862, I believe, he met with a group of prominent blacks, including Frederick Douglass, and told them that he was establishing a commission to explore the possibility of Panama as a place that they would all be sent. And but he was killed by obviously at the very end of the war, and it's not clear what he would have done. And essentially, the Civil War ended slavery in a dramatic way, which no one was prepared for, and there was no effort to try to move them. The people in the North didn't care because as long as they kept them in the South, that was okay. And the actual number of free blacks in the North was relatively small, and they could be kept in segregated neighborhoods. But I guess what I'm going to is that there's a deep pool of racism that's been present in American society from the beginning, and it's not going away.
And we saw in the last couple of years when the veil was lifted that it's deeper, wider, and more virulent than we thought.
That's right. And that, you know, Martin Luther King liked to say that the arc of the universe moves towards justice. And he got that phrase from Theodore Parker, a 19th century New England theologian. But it's, you know, it was a belief that, you know, the civil rights movement has history at its back, that the winds of the future were all winds in the direction of a more biracial society. I think he's right. And that's a Jeffersonian idea, by the way. And but that the liberal tradition is a kind of constant improvement and civilization goes forward. But I think the pattern in American history is not a steady movement forward. It's a movement forward and a half a step back, a step forward, another half a step back. And we're in one of the step back moments right now. And a demagogue can play to this with great effectiveness because the feelings and the unspoken values are very deep and very powerful. And I think the race card up until fairly recently had to be played face down. I think now, under Trump, the race card is being played sort of face up.
Well, that's a great insight. Let me ask you this. We're talking to Dr. Joseph Ellis, the author of American Dialogue, The Founders and Us, a book to be published by Knopf in October of 2018. Joe, you've been on this program before. You know, we both have a deep, deep fascination with Thomas Jefferson. It's a two-part question. The first part is this. What's the truth here? Do you believe, as a historian who's looked at all of this, that we can be a biracial or multiracial republic?
I think we not only can, but we have no choice.
But let me ask the question in a different fashion, because I know you know that it's not a frivolous question. If the backlash is, to read it in the most high-minded way, is about anxiety over globalization, and if the backlash is about concern about Islamic terrorism, and if the backlash is about the porousness of our borders and the possibility that there is a dilution of what it means to be a citizen, and if the backlash is about a feeling that our leaders are no longer attempting to really listen and hearken to us, then that backlash is worth coming to terms with, respecting, entering a dialogue with, reading in the best possible way, and trying to re-embrace into the republic. Isn't that what Jefferson would want to say?
Yes, and it's what any sensible person now, I think, would want to say. But that that the forces that are creating economic inequality, especially out there in the heartland, there's ways to respond to those. Sensibly, I mean, if we really were to rebuild the infrastructure of America, that would have an enormous economic advantage. Community colleges need to prepare rising generations with the kind of tools to have the jobs of the future. But technology is going to replace all of those manufacturing jobs, and they're never coming back. And speaking truthfully to people, coal is never coming back. And instead of looking for someone to blame, can we come together and look to find out how we can move forward. There aren't too many people in American history who've lasted very long as national leaders who have told us that the answer lies behind us. It's not like, again, the answer is in front of us. And Reagan always said, it's always morning in America. It's not night, it's midday, and we got to go forward. And that means coming up with some real solutions that reform the economies of Appalachia and provide the heartland with options that they don't have right now.
But if I agree so much with what you're saying, I think this is just such an important discussion, and I think your book is going to make a real difference. If we want that dialogue, I think you will agree it doesn't do any good to call these people morons, Neanderthals, racists,
no,
sexists.
No, they're not. I mean, or what do they call them, deplorables?
Right. that's no dialogue
yeah, I
there.
Mean, and you know, once we occupy these separate apps for, you know, MSNBC versus Fox News and everything, the possibility for honest conversation almost automatically ends. And again, one of the conceits of my book is that it is based on 44 years of teaching in liberal arts, well, West Point, Yale, Mount Holyoke, Amherst, but mostly Mount Holyoke, that if you didn't believe that there was stuff back there in the past that helps you in your life now, then what in heaven's name have I been doing all these years? And and there is stuff back there in the same way that in our old age we can remember things that help us and learn from the experience that we've had along the way. History is a memory bank that extends further back than our own lives. And I think I've found it that if you start a conversation about some controversial issue in the present, it doesn't get very far. But if you can ground it in the past and show that the issues at stake have a history, it's more likely to provide civility and for an honest exchange.
You've sold a lot of books in the course of your distinguished career, Passionate Sage, the character of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx, rather, Passionate Sage on Adams, the Summer of Revolution, etc.
Yeah. Founding Brothers was my biggest seller, yeah.
So what is your dream for this book, American Dialogue, The Founders and Us?
I try not to have dreams about these. Each of your books is like, I have no way of knowing. I mean, someone once said that every author could have entitled every one of his or her books Great Expectations. And I don't want to predict that. I do hope that it serves the purpose of starting some productive and constructive arguments.
Well, I hope that if people are listening to this, they will contact Bill Maher and get you out to L.A. for his show. I do believe that you being on Bill Maher as his guest to talk in a playful, thoughtful, but somber way about where we are and where we're headed is the best thing that could happen to this country. Joseph Ellis, we look forward to the book. I can't wait to interview you. We'll have you on for a full hour here in the next few weeks. And you're always welcome here whenever you have anything you want to say to Jefferson Hour listeners. We get a tremendous amount of feedback when you're on the program and people say, more Joe.
All right, I'm ready for it.
Once again, our special thanks to Professor Joseph Ellis. His new book, American Dialogue, will be released this October. In the write-up, it says, as the title suggests, and the founders knew, argument itself is the answer. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. I so enjoyed listening to that conversation with you and Mr. Ellis.
No dogs this time. Remember the last time you had like seven mastiffs in the background?
No, I don't think it was that. But there were a couple of statements he made that we didn't have time for it.
Well, we'll be talking with him at much greater length once we've had a chance to read the book. But we had planned just to sort of hear why you wrote the book. And then we got into what I think is a very, very, very interesting and somewhat problematic discussion. And I'll tell you what the most problematic thing for me was, David, is that when you talk about what's right and what's wrong with America, Jefferson is in both camps almost always.
Let me add just one more piece from Professor Ellis that we didn't have time for in the last segment.
There are, Jefferson is the most resonant figure in the founding because he simultaneously wrote the magic words of American history that gave us the foundation for the liberal tradition, He's on the other side, he's one of our most prominent racists. And but more than just that, there's a kind, as you know, I think that there's a kind of parallel tracks inside him that never cross. But I think that Jefferson was in favor of replacing the Constitution every 21 years.
That's right, once per generation. That's what I was kind of pointing to, is that there is this, there's this kind of loopy side of Jefferson, but he's kind of a utopian, radical, Democrat,
I mean,
in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's reason Mao said you need a revolution, you know, every just to sweep out the collected debris of the arteries of the, and it's a radical utopian idea that's kind of crazy and anarchistic in its implications, but there's a principle in the middle of it that is, you know, interesting and very revealing about Jefferson, but it is utopian.
But he believed it. I mean, it's not posturing, is it? He believed that we're up to it. He believed that we could.
He never apologized for it or rejected it. And
why did he believe that we're up to it? Because his friend John Adams was saying, "Have you looked around, buddy?" You know, because human nature didn't stop at the shore.
And, you know, and Madison told him, you know, that this is a crazy idea because generations don't, you know, generations don't come intact and leave intact in some mathematical way. And, Madison had spent his early career creating this document. And now Jefferson said, well, we'll trash this every 21 years. It's a reason that Jefferson speaks to a kind of romantic but an utopian set of convictions. It's intended to be almost a principled philosopher, and he's doing that. And if you let him in control, we would have ended up anarchy, you know. And if you let Hamilton in control, we might have ended up being an autocracy.
Well, I think Jefferson would say, "Give it a try," you know. That have we?
What's there to lose?
It's sort of what Trump said, to the black people of the South Chicago. I mean, I think Jefferson's view is, well, we've never had a chance for humans to really try. What if we let them govern themselves? What if we educated them? What if we?
That's a good question, but obviously that's never going to happen.
That was a great description of Jefferson.
He's the answer. The abolitionists used him. He's about the trajectory of justice and progress. He believes the future will be better than the past. He believes in taking seriously these movements like the Whiskey Rebellion and now the Trump movement. And yet he's also the problem.
And he continues to be.
Jefferson is both the answer to our issues about high-mindedness and civility and progress, but he's also
America's,
kind of stuck
he's
in
also
his own
America's leading
passion.
Racist.
That's what Joe said, that he is. I was shocked. He said, the leading racist in American history.
Yep.
He can't mean that, but you take his point.
Well, you know.
Davis, you know, Pitchfork Ben Tillman.
We can't really rank them.
But you take his point, a very serious racist.
Yeah. Before we go to this week's essay, I didn't have time. You know, we were talking about civility and how to do better arguments. And, you know, I came across something that I had saved in my notes that was published in the Irish Times,
what's
May
that?
11th, 2016, by Laura Kennedy.
Laura Kennedy.
And the title is Coping, How to Argue with Civility the Thomas Jefferson Way.
Really?
Don't you recall this?
Yes, I do.
It was about you.
Really?
Yes, it was about the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And she writes at the end, her partner is all upset by an argument. And she says, as he slumped on the sofa, I remembered Clay Jenkinson, a respected American academic. He hosts a podcast called The Thomas Jefferson Hour. In it, he assumes the persona of the third president of the United States, on whom he is an expert. And in a comfortingly deep and articulate voice, he brings Jefferson back into modern relevance, articulating his views on incredibly varied topics from philosophy and modern politics to gardening.
I think the correct answer.
I just read that out loud just for you.
I think I blush. Let me tell you something
else. It's a great article, though. She talks about how, you know, Jefferson and the artificial good humor and sort of what we talked about
harmony,
at the beginning
civility,
of the show.
Respect, tolerance,
take winning
truth.
Off the table, embrace vulnerability, pay attention to context, be open, and be a purveyor of civil discourse.
And you know how I beg for stuff on this program?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kevin,
you know, I edited
Moiderman,
that all out.
Really?
Yeah.
Not enough.
Yeah.
Because Kevin Moiderman has written to me. He is an instrument maker. He heard me begging for a ukulele, and making me one. He's making me.
Fabulous.
And I want to have him on the show. He's a master craftsman.
Right. And you've received a painting as well.
I received a painting. I mean, look.
Yeah, you're spoiled.
Begging works.
You're spoiled.
So send stuff, is what I'm saying. But also, the cultural tours, I had maybe the best time I've ever had on the Lewis and Clark Trail.
I don't even think you should bring them up because they're all selling out already.
No. We had the two winter encampments, Water in the West, that's January 13th through 18th, and then Shakespeare Without Tears, January 19th through 24th, at Locksaw Lodge, west of Missoula, and then Steinbeck's, California, March 2nd through 8th, 2019. These are unbelievably satisfying.
Go to jeffersonhour.com. You can find out all the details, and you can support the show.
And they all asked for you again, where's David? Why won't the semi-permanent guest host get in the canoe? And I don't have any answer.
Well, just tell them I am terrified of the Wendover March. And with that, sir, thank you for a great conversation. But right now, it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
When people say that the internet and the digitization of culture represent something as important as the invention of movable type by Gutenberg in the 15th century, I usually wonder if that can be true. The Gutenberg Revolution gave us the Reformation. Luther was the first publishing phenomenon in human history. And later, when it had settled down a bit, it gave us the Scientific Revolution and then the Enlightenment. The first website is generally dated to 1995. As of today, there are 1.5 billion websites worldwide, about 200 million of which are active. Facebook dates to February 4th, 2004, my birthday, by the way, when I was 49 years old. As of today, there are approximately 2 billion Facebook users. If the digital revolution merits comparison with the Gutenberg Revolution, we should wonder what it will do for humankind. What would Mr. Jefferson think? Well, let's look at a few of the results. First, it knits the world together. My mother died a month ago today. She was 86. My daughter flew out from New York City. We handled some of the logistics of death certificates, cremation, banking, and the laws of inheritance. We looked for her address book. Her handwriting was appalling, so that we could inform her friends, but that proved to be unnecessary. At my daughter's suggestion, I posted 3 short tributes to my mother on Facebook, and within a few hours of her death, the word had traveled to all 50 states and far beyond. Thanks to social media, everyone who needed to know was informed within a few hours of my mother's death. By the time the obituary appeared in North Dakota newspapers, it was old news. The internet has knit the world together so completely that my internet notice, a series of numerical codes representing the English alphabet, hurtled out of my keyboard like lightning and reached everyone in my little cosmos instantly, and then each person who knew Mother passed that news on to his or her network, family, friends, acquaintances, colleagues, and within an hour or two, everyone everywhere who needed to know knew. 15 years ago, I would have clipped out the obituary from the print edition of the Dickinson Press, photocopied it at a Kinko's or a post office, folded the copies after writing a brief penned note on each one, put them into envelopes, bought stamps, deposited the envelopes in a postal box, after which humans would have canceled the stamps, sorted the mail by zip code, put it into trucks and planes, and delivered it 4 or 5 days later into boxes at residences all over the United States. The response to my Facebook post was overwhelming. In the course of a week, several thousand people took the time to write tributes to my late mother, who was for a quarter century an English teacher at Dickinson High School in western North Dakota. The tributes were fabulous. If you ran a statistical analysis of how many of those individuals would have taken the time, assuming they had even heard the news, to successfully complete the process of ascertaining my street address, buying a card, writing a tribute, and then putting it with a stamp into the mail, I'm guessing it would have received a tiny fraction of the number of tributes that actually appeared by way of social media. For the first time, I found myself celebrating Mark Zuckerberg. No cat memes, no assaults on Obama, no New Age mantras, no instructions how to combine the keyword of your favorite Beatles song with the brand of your first car to determine your Cold War spy name, Jude Falcon, or Sun Escort. Jefferson would have loved the ways in which the internet connects us to those far away, instantly and seemingly at no cost. He was always scolding his daughters and his friends for not writing him more. Think of the number of people who routinely post photos of themselves and their children who would never or rarely send prints to aunts, parents, grandparents, or in-laws. Second, think of the potential knowledge explosion the digital world represents. Just one example. The great Encyclopedia Britannica contains approximately 40,000 articles in approximately 40 volumes. Try lugging that load along on your summer vacation to Rome. There are currently 5,021,417 articles in the English version alone of Wikipedia, and all of them are contained in your smartphone, free, 24 hours per day, anywhere on Earth. There are those who will still try to claim that Britannica is better and more reliable than Wikipedia, of course, but errors in Wikipedia can be corrected instantly, whereas a factual error in Britannica would have to wait for the next printing, and by the way, there won't be a next printing. If Jefferson had had a smartphone, he would have considered himself the most fortunate man who had ever lived. Already, there are 30 million volumes available free on Google Books, and they won't stop until every book ever written is available to anyone with an imagination to access them. There's absolutely no excuse for ignorance now, because if you really want to know how much the National Health Service of Great Britain costs each citizen per year, you can know that, and you can find out if it is really true that you have to wait 3 years for a routine knee replacement in Scotland or Wales. And yet, as we all know, most people would rather wallow in willful ignorance than look something up and get their facts right, because we don't really want to know, we merely want to score points. Third, thanks to the digital revolution, everyone now is a publisher. In the past, if you wanted to inform the world of your theory that black helicopters operated by former Israeli spies were spreading fluoride on the lettuce fields of Central Valley in California to lull us to sleep before our guns are confiscated by liberals, you'd either need a mimeograph machine and a bunch of stamps, or you would have to try to slip your conspiracy theory past the city editor of a newspaper, and at least the most vicious ad hominem in your letter to the editor would be left on the cutting room floor. Today, anyone anywhere can throw any notion, theory, accusation, innuendo up into the internet cosmos, and given how completely the world is now instantly connected, you are probably going to get thousands or even millions of likes, even if you argue that Lee Harvey Oswald was President Obama's great-grandfather. Talk about the law of unintended consequences. I read the other day that a serious peer-reviewed journal shows that false news, fake news, actually travels more quickly and more effectively than the truth. You may have seen the meme a few months ago in which a group of black NFL players seemed to be celebrating the burning of the American flag in a locker room. A friend, I use air quotes here, of mine from northern Idaho sent that photo to her entire contact list, accompanied by a pious and outraged cover note about how that photo allows us to see how profoundly un-American and unpatriotic African-American athletes really are, after all that we have done for them. That sort of thing. The minute I saw that photo, I knew it was a fake, if for no other reason, and there are many, than that nobody sets fire to a flag in a locker room. Once I scrutinized the photo for 30 seconds, I saw how crudely it had been photoshopped and cut and pasted by someone, a racist, a super patriot, a right-wing extremist, or President Trump's 400-pound guy in his mother's basement, to discredit the protest movement begun by Colin Kaepernick. 20 years ago, this could not have happened. Doctoring the photo would have been difficult and time-consuming. Not anymore. Any moron can doctor a photo now, and there are programs and apps that make it easy and encourage such manipulations. The old adage that a picture never lies is no longer operative. A child's sex ring in D.C.? In a pizza shop run by the Clintons? How addled does your brain have to be to believe this could be true? Obama planned to declare martial law and install himself permanently as president? If you look up the wackiest and most undeniably wrong political claims, you will find that millions of people either believe them or pretended to believe them for political advantage and shared them out, too. The internet has brought about a radical democratization of publishing. It all looks professional because of the uniform graphic sophistication of the web world, and without even the slightest peer review, now anything goes. P.T. Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute. Maybe the most depressing fact of our time is how susceptible millions and millions of people are to false news, fake news, lies, innuendo, conspiracy theories, and pure BS. Jefferson famously said, if you expect to be a nation ignorant and free, you expect what never has been and never can be. Well, here we are. We now know beyond doubt that the Russians plant fake news to destabilize American democracy. And it works. Tens of millions of people are taken in by these base manipulations. They and their worthy leader refuse to acknowledge that this is a problem, and some of them are now actually seen wearing T-shirts that say, I would rather be Russian than a Democrat. Oh my. How do we recover from all of this? I hear the seventh seal being opened, perhaps by a cat playing a piano in white gloves. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.